You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Back from a nice holiday with family and friends. I hope you had the same. In the third hour of our program, we are going to be asking the question, is Grover Norquist an enemy of the state? This goes a little more, we're going to get into this a little more depth than you've probably heard before. And I want to share with you something about the pledge, the oath of office, that you probably didn't know. We'll get into that in our third hour. In our second hour, Damon Vix is dropping by, a militant atheist. We're going to be asking the question, did the Grinch steal Christmas in Santa Monica? In our first hour, I'm going to get into this rant about Black Friday, but I am in front of me. Those of you on TV can watching us on TV can see it. I am holding in my hands the holiday 2012 issue of Hustler magazine, which has a two-page spread in it. No pun intended. Titled "Who Shot Santa?" by Tom Hartman and Sam Sachs. The subhead, have you ever wondered why the Democrats turned against their own core principles? Here's a clue. If Scrooge were around, he'd be a Republican. There you go. That's the two-page spread. There you, those of you watching on TV, you can see it. Those of you on radio, sorry, you're going to have to pick up a copy of Holiday 2012 Hustler. Well, not sorry. Whatever. Great. Just for the articles, of course. Of course. Okay. Every year after Thanksgiving, the nation's wealthy elite, right, still fat-bellied from turkey and stuffing, tune into their local news outlets to observe, to watch, with the gravy drooling down there from the edges of their mouths, watch what has become an annual tradition of bloodletting and frenzied consumerism. We call it Black Friday. But to those like the Walmart heirs, who together own more wealth than the bottom 40% of the nation combined, it might as well be called their very own Hunger Games. It's their store, after all, that played host to this one-day battle waged by poor and working-class people to get discounted appliances, clothes, toys for their kids. Like Suzanne Collins' dystopic future portrayed in The Hunger Games. Remember the movie? I'm sure far more people saw the movie than read the book. But the movie is a piece of the book. But in any case, the bottom line is it's about impoverished teenagers battling each other to the death once a year for the amusement of that world's Panem's wealthy elite. So much like that, Black Friday's battle royales, tragically, often end in death here in the United States. In just the last few years, we've seen shoppers and retail workers shot to death, trampled to death, pepper sprayed, bitten, punched, kicked, all in the pursuit of Black Friday shopping deals. This year was no different. Two people were shot outside a Walmart in Tallahassee, Florida. Another two people were run down by a car in a Walmart parking lot in Covington, Washington. At a Sears store in San Antonio, Texas, one guy punched his way to the front of the line, literally punched his way to the front of the line, only to have another guy pull a gun on him. In every year around this time, the phrase "clean up on aisle 5 takes on a much more disturbing meaning. All while the wealthy elite look down on the spectacle before them with amusement and, most importantly, the knowledge that the entire spectacle is fattening their bank accounts. This Black Friday hunger game is actually a pretty new phenomenon. The term has been around since the 60s. It was mostly used by factory managers talking about the number of people who called in sick after Thanksgiving. But in the 1980s, retail outlets noticed that their balance sheets at the end of that Friday would be black for the year. This was the point at the year where in the arc of the year where all of your income met all of your expenses and suddenly your store was in the black. So they called it Black Friday. It was the unofficial start of the holiday shopping season, but it was also the point in time where if a store successfully made it through that Friday, then they knew that basically everything from then until Christmas was profit. After years of relentless marketing to lure shoppers to their stores at bargain prices, Black Friday has officially become the number one busiest shopping day of the year. Started in 2005, officially, the busiest day of the year. That year, nearly half the nation, that was 140 million Americans, went shopping on Black Friday. This year, over 240 million Americans jumped into this stampeding chaos. But to blame the rise of Black Friday and effective marketing is to miss more than half the story. Black Friday, in reality, is a symptom of the plight that 30 years of Reaganomics has brought to working people in America. Right along with the frenzied rise of shoppers willing to fight each other in retail outlets across America, we've been steadily, for the last 30 years, watching the destruction of organized labor, of labor unions, of decent pay and wages and conditions for working people. Where a third of the workforce was unionized just two generations ago, only a tenth is today. Alongside the drop in unionization rates, the middle class's share of national income has also dropped off significantly, as reflected in their wages. Adjusted for inflation, in 1988, this was just before Black Friday came about in its modern form, average American worker made $33,400. By 2008, the average American worker was actually making less. $800 a year less, $33,000 a year. While virtually every cost of living borne by the working class, from housing to food to pharmaceuticals, have exploded. All the while, the wealthy elite, the top 1%, they've seen their income not go down like working people, but rise 275% since 1979. With the price of everything from food to energy to education to housing to health care, it's all exploding. More and more working Americans have to make tough choices. Christmas presents or the heating bill? And that's where the retail giants stepped in. The retail industry, which employs more than a third of our nation's low-wage workers, created Black Friday with a promise that shoppers can save big if they hit the stores on this one special day. Frankly, the only thing shoppers have left is to enter themselves into Walmart's Hunger Game, where they literally claw and bite each other to get one of those 40% off kitchen appliances. With only limited quantities available, you've seen that asterisk on the flyers, and thousands of people waiting in line outside. Then the message that gets given to young warriors in the Hunger Games applies to the shoppers readying themselves to the mad dash for the kitchenware section. It's the same message. I mean, literally the same message as out of the book and the movie. May the odds be ever in your favor. But to the 50 million Americans in poverty and the fifth of the nation living in economic insecurity, what other choice do they have if they want their kids to have a decent Christmas? Or if they just want to get, you know, a coffee pot that works. We have Black Friday today because the wealthy elite have strangled their workers for 32 years. Ever since Ronald Reagan's election, Time magazine in 1966, back before Reagan, saw a future of rising productivity thanks to machines, computers, and thus rising wages for workers. They said that a leisure society was coming. In fact, they calculated that the average full-time 40-hour-a-week worker by the year 2000 would be making $100,000 to $120,000 a year. Or, alternatively, just working a 25-hour week for the same pay as back in the 60s. And sure enough, productivity did increase at that rate, just like Time magazine predicted. Unfortunately, all that extra wealth hasn't gone to the working people. Instead, it went to the top 1%. Thus, the Black Friday Hunger Games. Isn't this bizarre? I mean, it's not the rich who are stampeding the stores. This is the new and tragic American spectacle. And we should be looking at this saying, this is a symptom of a society in dysfunction. It's time to end the Hunger Games. It's time to end Black Friday. It's time to pay people decent wages.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And a good starting point would be to raise the minimum wage, at least back to where it was in 1960. Which in today's dollars would be somewhere between 10 and 12 bucks an hour. So did you participate in, speaking of the Hunger Games, Hungry Heart Did you participate in the Hunger Games over the weekend? We went out to Oregon to visit Louise's mom and brother, and our son and one of our daughters showed up along with her partner, her friend, and it was a wonderful time. And Justin and I went to the store to pick up some fixins for Thanksgiving dinner, which we had on Friday because Louise and I flew on Thanksgiving on Thursday, so we could be here on Wednesday and do the show for you guys. And so we were there. We were in a giant, in fact, it wasn't Walmart. It was a Fred Meyer. It was kind of the local equivalent. We were in one of these giant stores on Black Friday, and only we were shopping the food section. The food section was pretty empty. Every place else, though, it was a madhouse. It was an absolute madhouse. At what point do we as Americans look at this whole situation and say, you know, this isn't funny. This isn't entertainment. This shouldn't be the topic of news stories on network news for a week before Black Friday, you know, where they're interviewing all these retail. How's Black Friday going to be this year? Is it going to be a good year? Is a lot of people going to show up? What's going on? Credit card companies, let's see what they have to say. All this stuff. It's like we're celebrating the day when people who don't earn enough money to be able to get the latest toy for their kid might be able to afford to get it if they're one of the first 25 people in line. Louise and I did this once. I mean, it's only been since the mid-80s that Black Friday's even been around. So, you know, before that, we would go shopping whenever we went shopping, and we'd just never been into shopping all that much anyway. But there was one time when we were living in Portland. In fact, it was right after we had moved there. It must have been about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And we hadn't had a TV in years. I mean, we hadn't, and for 18 years, we had no television. We raised our kids without TV. That was the whole point of it. And I was doing the radio show, and it was like, okay, we've got to get a TV. We've got to see what's going on. And the Black Friday sale came out the first that we had moved to Portland that spring and that fall. The sale flyer came, and here was one for a fairly large electronics store in Portland. And if I remembered with certainty the name of the store, I would mention them, but it could be one of several, and I'm not sure, and I don't want to trash a store without being accurate. But it was one of those flyers stuck into the previous Sunday's paper or into Christmas's Thursday Thanksgiving's paper or whatever. And they had these like 32 or 36 inch flat screen TVs. Now back then that was big, right? And I don't remember the price, but it was like half off. I mean, these, you know, TVs back then, those big flat screen TVs were selling for like $1,000. And it was like $300 or $400. And there was that little asterisk, and down at the bottom in the little tiny type, it said limited quantities. So we thought, okay, we'll show up, you know, when the store opens. The store opened at 9. So we drove over to the store. You know, what the heck, it's Friday morning. Drove over to the store. 9 o'clock in the morning. And the store was already filled with people. I mean, we got there maybe 15 minutes after the doors had opened. And it was already jammed with people. People were just pouring out. And we went over to the TV section. This was a big box store. Went over to the TV section. Found the TVs that had this, it was, as I recall, more than half price off offer. And none of them had discounted stickers. And so I grabbed a sales guy and I said, do these just automatically ring up at $300 instead of the $600 or $700 it says on the price, you know, when we get to the checkout counter? And he was like, no, that was the limited supply. It's already gone. And I said, how many did you have at that price? And he said, well, it was at least one. And I was like, you're kidding. And he says, no, it's just a couple of them. And he says, I know it was at least one. We had to do that to satisfy the legal requirements of the ad. But he said it wasn't very many, and they were gone within the first 30 seconds, first minute. And now what we've got is this big stack of the same TV, only twice the price. And I was inclined, I was tempted to just buy the damn TV because we'd, you know, we've made this huge trip and all this hassle, and there they were, you know, 6 inches from me. And then I thought, screw that. I am not going to reward this store for that kind of behavior. I mean, this should be a crime. This is where regulations that, you know, the wall, oh, we can't have regulations. This is where regulations should come in. If you advertise a discounted item at a discounted price, you should have enough stock at that price to satisfy the demand. Not just enough stock to be able to put it in your damn ad. So instead, I went home and, you know, did some searching around on the internet and found something reasonable and smaller, and we bought it, and it hung on our wall for a couple of years, and I think our son inherited it. But and I went on the air. I was doing the morning show on KPOJ at that time, as well as this show, and went on the air and told this story. And it's just, you know, has that happened to you? Should this be outlawed? Or would the libertarians say, oh, that's the nanny state. That's the big government protecting you from trying to protect you from yourself. Knowing what's better for you than what you know for yourself. You really want the nanny state forcing stores to have a certain amount of inventory? Well, frankly, my answer is yes. But beyond that, we shouldn't even be having these spectacles. These spectacles are the consequence of productivity that should have at least doubled workers' wages since 1966, and instead we've seen them go down. That's crazy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And where did all the extra money from that increased productivity since the 60s go? To the top 1%. Five Walmart heirs worth more than 40% of America.
I hate Walmart.
I hate Walmart.
If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big companies sell the low cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart.
Yes, welcome back. I don't absolutely hate Walmart. I just don't like their labor practices. You know, the fact of the matter is that if Walmart was paying a decent wage and decent benefits to their employees, everything in the store might be a few pennies more. I mean, we're talking, you know, fractions of percentages. But or maybe single-digit percentages. But is it, you know, is it really worth it? Is it really worth it that five people who own the majority of the Walmart stock are worth more right now than the bottom 40% of Americans? And every year on Black Friday, they get to sit there after their Thanksgiving dinner and watch with glee while the bottom 40% of Americans are clawing over each other, shooting each other, punching each other, kicking each other, screaming to give more money to the Walton family. Really? That's the country we live in? That's the country we want to live in? That's what George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Thomas Paine and Ben Franklin and all the guys, you know, that's what these guys all fought for, and all the men and women who died for this country. So the one family could have 40% of all the wealth in the country? Tell me we're not a royal family, a royal society. The royal family in England does not own 40% of the wealth of that country. I don't know what the percentage is, but I guarantee it's not 40%. Shane has this look on his face like he's going for the Google machine. Good on you, Shane. As soon as you know, let me know. Or maybe somebody in the chat room will. But you know, it's just, this is nuts. Joe in Pompano Beach, it says you disagree with me about the minimum wage. If you disagree, you go to the front of the line, Joe. What's on your mind?
Okay, thanks a lot. I listen to you. I'm one of those Scrooge people. I'm a Republican, but not entirely mean and evil to people.
Well, you can read the whole Scrooge thing over in the current issue, or the holiday issue of Hustler, by the way, if you want to read about it.
In any event, you said to be back to the wages in the 67 dollars a night. Says, well, minimum wage today, you know, passed in July of 2009 is $7.25 for anyone in any state. Now, other people obviously exceed that $7.25 because you're not going to get a lot of people, depending on your skill level, to get a job. Our company, we pay a minimum of $10 for a warehouseman, and he gets an increase every year, and he gets a bonus around Christmas. We provide health.
Well, good on you. Walmart starts people out at around $8, and after 6 years, they can make their way to $9. Now, in my opinion, any company is paying people that poorly. You know, the largest employer in the United States that has the largest number of employees who are on food stamps and taking welfare benefits and Medicaid is Walmart. I don't think that that's a business model. What they're doing is they're internalizing profit and externalizing costs. You and I, Joe, you and me, entrepreneurs, both of us, you own a business, I own a business. We are paying for the health care, for the food stamps, for the subsidized housing. We are paying for the cost, the externalized cost, for Walmart to do business in this country. I think that's wrong.
Well, I'm not going to comment on Walmart one way or the other because there are many successful corporations not at the Walmart level. They pay much higher wages to people.
God bless them. I pay a lot higher than Walmart, and we offer full benefits to our employees. That's not my point. My point is that any company that is going to be that penurious should not be doing business in this country.
Well, they bring a lot of revenue to our nation, too, as well.
No, they don't. They send a lot of revenue out of our nation to China. You walk into a Walmart and try to find one thing made in America that's actually bringing revenue into this country. I dare you.
Well, in that regard, I agree with you, but the point is, who's going to change it? No one. I mean, it's just a fact of how
No, Joe, the Democrats, when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, the Democrats passed a law, an amendment to the tax code, simple amendment to the tax code, that simply said that if you want to do what Bain Capital is doing right now with Sensata, the manufacturing company in Ohio, if you want to take apart a factory and ship all of its pieces over to China or any other country, any other low-wage country, you can no longer get a tax break for doing that. Bain Capital is actually making a profit on sending Sensata overseas. And then on top of that, as long as Bain Capital manufactures that, you know, the Sensata parts in China and sells them back to them to another division of themselves here in the United States, they can sell from China to the United States. Let's say that the part's worth $100 and it costs $10 to make. Okay, just for the purposes of argument. So you've got a $90 spread there. If they choose to, they can sell that part from their Chinese factory to their American wholesaler that then sells them to, these are sensors for cars, that then sells them to GM and Ford and whatnot. They can sell them to themselves for $99, which means that $59 of the profit or 99% of the profit stays outside the United States where it's not taxed. And then they can use that profit to do other things, including things inside the United States. You know, if you run them through tax shelters in the Caymans, this is insane. So Nancy Pelosi passed a law saying not only can you no longer get a tax break for taking your factory apart and shipping it overseas, and not only can you no longer keep determine for yourself what price you're going to sell to yourself at, so you decide where the profit gets to stay, but you actually have to declare that profit as U.S. income since you are a U.S. company manufacturing overseas for U.S. sales. But third, any company that is already doing business overseas, if you want to move your operations back to the United States, we will give you a tax break to do that. We will cut your taxes. We will give you actually tax credits in some cases to do that. That was a brilliant piece of legislation. It passed by a majority in the United States House of Representatives, and it passed by a majority in the United States Senate. It got 55 votes out of 100 in the Senate. And guess what? It's not law today. Because a Republican whose name we still don't know because these cowards hide behind the Senate rules filibustered the damn thing. So you said there's nobody's going to do anything about it. That would have done something about it. And it wouldn't have hurt Walmart. It wouldn't have hurt anybody else. What it would have done is it would have brought American jobs back to America and you'd have people earning decent wages manufacturing. You can't have a modern industrialized country that has manufacturing as less than 20% of its GDP. It just doesn't work. It doesn't happen. You know, and 25 to 35% of our GDP from the founding of our country until the beginning of the Reaganomics era, between 25 and 35% of our total GDP was manufacturing. Sometimes it was even higher. I mean, during World War I, it was over 80%. But typically, most of our GDP is manufacturing, or not at most, but more than a quarter of our GDP is manufacturing. You know what it is right now? 10.2%. That's not a country that's viable. We're not making anything of value. When Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, you know what The Wealth of Nations was that he was talking about, Joe? The example that he used, The Wealth of Nations was converting raw materials, adding raw materials to human ingenuity and human labor to produce something of value. The example that he used in the book The Wealth of Nations was a tree limb laying on the ground. And he said that has no intrinsic value other than its possibility for firewood. But if you take that and you apply skilled labor to it and carve it into an axe handle, you have generated wealth that can last for multiple generations. That's how countries become wealthy. The wealth of nations is what they manufacture. And we understood that in the United States until Ronald Reagan became president, and we went insane. Your turn.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the comment about the wealth of nations. I'm going to have to look that up. Not that I dispute or disagree. It's an interesting economic point.
Well, it's common sense.
For a nation and a company. Yeah.
It's common sense.
Well, I can't control our legislators. You vote, I vote, we vote. They get up there and they do something alien.
No, but we can both raise hell with them. I mean, you know, I call my Democratic legislators and say, vote for this thing that's going to bring back manufacturing. You should call your Republican legislators and tell them the same thing.
I call constantly about every issue I could think about. I get some
good on you,
person that maybe a freshman in college or, you know, maybe some summer intern, and it goes nowhere. It's almost like, can I ever speak to a real congressman or a senator?
Well, you can if you show up. If you show up at their local office.
But how many people go run to Washington and
no, but you're in Pompano Beach.
I don't want a tour.
You're in Pompano Beach, Florida. My guess is that's a big enough town that whoever represents you in the House of Representatives, and I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head who that is, but say what?
It used to be Alan West. I don't know who
used to. Oh, geez.
I guess it's going to be the
okay.
Two guy.
Well, you know, fortunately, you now have a Democrat representing you, Tim Murphy, I think is his name, and he will have a district office, and he will be coming to your district regularly to do town halls. And whether you agree with him or disagree with him, and you know, I totally respect your right to disagree with him, and in fact, I honor it. I think that, you know, you and I both have an obligation to show up at those kinds of meetings and speak our truth.
Look, I've been a patriot to my nation my whole life. I retired from the agency, the CIA. I was a colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve.
God bless you, sir.
The block. I've been to bad places, and I love and I value our nation for all citizens, and I have no problem serving what I did serve, and that was an issue. But I find our country deteriorating because I'm not quite sure what our legislators do.
Yeah.
I don't know in your area of the country, but I've tried. I've called often and said, well, when's the congressman going to get back to the area so I could speak to him maybe over a holiday break or whatever? Well, he's quite busy. He's going to be, you know,
Well, that's the problem that you have with a lot of, I don't know if you've looked at the statistics, but Republican legislators are about a third as likely to hold events in their districts as Democrats are. And the reason why is because people show up and ask them questions like, do you really want to voucherize Medicare? And they don't like to answer the question. Now that you got a Democrat representing you, I think you're going to have a lot better luck, Joe, even if you disagree with it. So, you know, I wish you well on it. Thank you for being civically engaged. Thank you for the civil conversation. We need more Republicans like you. And, Joe, appreciate the call. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM Radio. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Shane just shared with me a story about why it was a good thing I didn't buy that cheap TV back. I'll tell you about that right after this, and we'll pick up your phone. This bad hustler joke there, Shane. That's okay. Anyway, welcome back. Exposing the Con and Conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. This is from ConsumerReports.org. Black Friday HD TV specials. How do they compare to standard models? I did not realize this. I thought that when you bought one of the cheap ones on Black Friday, you got one of the, you know, the same good one that you bought the day before. It turns out that most manufacturers actually make, they call them derivatives. Right. You know, you're in for trouble when it's called a derivative. And, you know, so they've got slightly different model numbers. And lower contrast ratio, only one HDMI input, no S-video input. It lacks in-picture, picture-in-picture, WiseLink Pro, blah blah blah. Basically, derivative quoting from Consumer Reports, derivative models typically sell for at least a few hundred dollars less than standard models, but in the season of ultimate volatility, it's hard to pin down pricing.
Jeez.
Anyhow, Ed, Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Tom, I was watching the Black Friday advertisements on TV, and I can't help but puzzle over the fact that nobody says on TV that the prices are going to be slightly higher in Oregon, because people in Oregon have to pay $8.80 an hour minimum wage, which is like 21% higher than the national minimum wage.
But see, the prices aren't higher in Oregon, Ed.
No, the prices are not higher in Oregon. Isn't that amazing? Somehow they can manage to afford to pay their employees 21% more than the rest of the country.
In fact, when that increase in the minimum wage went, and I know that you know this, Ed, when that wage, that increase in the minimum wage went up in Oregon, and the conservatives were all hysterical, especially the bloviators on right-wing talk radio, oh, my God, it's the end of the world. All these businesses are going to go out of business. Small companies can't compete. Blah, 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 blah. Turns out we actually saw an increase in economic activity because average working people or minimum wage working people suddenly had an extra buck in their pocket for every hour they worked. And what do they do with 100% of the money in their pocket? Typically, minimum wage workers, they spend it. And so they stimulated the economy. We actually, Oregon, I say we, I still own a house in Oregon. We saw, Oregonians saw an increase in economic activity as a result of the increase in the minimum wage. And if you look back at the minimum wage all the way to 1935 when it was created, every time it's been increased within a year or two thereafter, you know, and because it takes a while for these numbers to work their way through the economy, you see the GDP increase. So, Ed, thank you. Excellent point. Very well made. I appreciate it. Brent in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Brent, says the economy doesn't benefit from Black Friday.
It does not absolutely benefit from Black Friday. Here it is. We've got a lot of folks coming on now, spending money. Okay. Where are they getting the money?
They're borrowing it.
Exactly.
We're seeing one of the big news stories that I left me scratching my head. I saw this on one of the financial networks a week or so ago, is that consumer credit is up some percentage, 7-8%, whatever, over this point last year. Therefore, the economy's rebounding. No, you idiots.
Yay.
Therefore, the middle class is going deeper in debt.
God bless everybody.
Yes.
Yay.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah, I agree.
That's not good.
I agree.
That's not good. We are still, as Americans, living on our credit. We're living more in debt.
Yeah,
it just can't be good.
No, it can't be. And this is,
I've got more topics on this than my brain can actually put out in one sentence.
Well, this is why, you know, this didn't happen 30 years ago when people were earning the exact same amount of money that they're earning now. The average worker, actually, they were earning a little more. They were earning $800 a month or a year more. But the cost of living, the cost of everything, was a fraction of what it is now. It didn't happen 30 years ago. We didn't have this. We didn't have $1 trillion worth of student loan debt. We didn't have almost $1 trillion worth of credit card debt. And the reason why was because people could live within their means. But then as productivity continued to increase and all the profit from that productivity went to the top 1% instead of the workers, as it had from the George Washington until the Ronald Reagan administrations, during that 200-year period, if you graph productivity and wages, you find that those two numbers almost perfectly correspond. Suddenly in 1980, they split apart. And productivity continued to increase, but wages flattened out. So what filled in that gap for the workers? Credit. And where did all the money go from that added productivity? To the top 1%, to the people who own the stock and who own the factories. And that's no way to run a country.
That is no way to run a country. You're absolutely right. And I kind of want to switch topics here.
Now, hang on. It says here you're a conservative. You're agreeing with me.
I am a conservative. I'm absolutely a conservative. I believe that you should work hard for what you get. I do not believe in entitlement. I think entitlement is... I
don't
believe
to public
that
school?
You should take from,
Brent?
As Obama said, from the rich to take from the poor.
Brent?
Because as you can say, add up the numbers. If you take it up and add up the numbers, if you took from all the top 2%, it would be about $6 billion a year, and that would run our country for approximately 4 days.
Yeah, that's if you go back to the Clinton tax rates. Try going back to the Dwight Eisenhower tax rates. And by the way, those numbers are incredibly deceptive because they forget to point out, and whoever is giving you these numbers will never tell you this. Certainly Rush Limbaugh won't tell you this, that during the Eisenhower administration, 34% of the total revenue going into our federal government came from corporations. That number now is around 10%.
You know what? You're absolutely right.
And the balance of that has been made up by taxes on the middle class.
I agree with you. However, there's stipulations like GE. GE in 2010 made the most money out of any corporation in America.
And paid no income taxes.
They were overseas. However, they did not pay 1 cent in taxes.
Right. And they've got several hundred offshore, tax havens to make sure that happens, just like Mitt Romney did. I'm totally with you. It is time to say enough already. In fact, fully a quarter. First of all, well over 90% of all corporations in America pay no income tax, but most of them are small companies. And so, small business owners zero them out. That makes sense. But one quarter of companies with over 500 employees who showed a profit the year before last, the last year that we have statistics for, a quarter of them paid no income taxes. There's something deeply wrong with that. Brent, thank you for the call. I keep getting conservatives agreeing with me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just got a text message from Sam Sachs, producer of The Big Picture, who I work with on the TV show, saying that he can't find a copy of the Hustler magazine, the holiday issue, on any of the newsstands around Washington, D.C. Poor Sam. We got ours in the mail. Yeah, Sam and I have an article in it. That's why I mentioned that. So, anyhow, you said our guest is on line 11. Oh, there's line 11. Took me a minute to find it. Damon Vicks is on the line with us. Damon, let me set this up a little bit. Every year, Fox News, every year for the last, I don't know how many years Fox News has been around. The first 5 years they were in business, they lost $100 million a year. They were kind of a marginal thing. And then they got traction. They got a billionaire behind them after all. And they do this, it's the war on Christmas, don't you know? Those nasty atheists, they're out to get the Christians.
They're coming to get you.
As if it's like, it's the Taliban or something, right? So the war on Christmas continues, and the latest Christmas warrior is Damon Vicks. He is an atheist. He objected to a actually, why am I telling you his story? He's on the line with us. Damon, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So, first of all, tell me what's going on. Are you really the Grinch who stole Christmas in Santa Monica?
No, I think Christmas will still happen this year. I am kind of a pro-separation church of state guy and pro.
Oh, you mean like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, those guys?
Exactly, Jefferson and...
Oh, man.
Yeah, I like those guys. Always have.
Yeah, I do too, but if you're going to be the Grinch who stole Christmas, I mean, you're supposed to like Karl Marx or something. Although Karl Marx was an atheist too, I guess. So. Aha! Yeah. Proof!
Aha! You're right.
But in any case.
So, yes, Christmas is going to happen, but it will be a little different this year in Santa Monica.
Mm-hmm.
The city built a whole block of displays in 1954, and this will be the second time since then that these displays have not been set up.
Now, the city, I'm guessing you're talking about Christmas decorations, some secular, like Christmas trees, which are arguably secular.
There are palm trees in the park, but not a single Rudolph or Santa Claus. It's strictly Bible quotes and life-size depictions of the Nativity.
It's pretty hard to argue that that's not religious stuff. I mean, you can have a debate about a Christmas tree because it goes, Christmas trees go way back before Christianity. But the nativity scene or Bible quotes, that's pretty clearly religious stuff. Is this owned by the city or do they simply make the park available to people to put it up?
It is no longer owned by the city, but the city built these in 1954 with the Chamber of Commerce and owned them and operated this program of setting up 14, I think, of these displays, a whole city block lit up with power. And they did that until 1979 when they decided, after a threat of a lawsuit from the ACLU, to divest interest. So on paper, they don't own the displays, but the display program carried on exactly as it had been.
So do they let all religions have a place in their city park in San Diego?
Well, this particular program has been open to the public since 1979 at least, but it wasn't really an advertised program. There really weren't rules. They just sort of set up a system where the nativity scenes can go up as they had always been put up.
Yeah.
And only a couple small displays had ever been put up. One menorah and a very small atheist gnome has been put up.
So your religion is represented, too, by a gnome, though. I've never heard of a gnome representing atheism.
It was a little gnome with a Charles Darwin face, and it said on his little cap, Reasons Greetings.
Reasons
and
Greetings.
And it was vandalized and destroyed. It was very tiny, which was It was just obscured by these very large, numerous displays that had been set up for so many years.
Yeah. So what role are other? Did you supply the atheist gnome?
No, there was a local group called Atheist United supplied that gnome, but I saw that and I thought, well, we shouldn't have just one little gnome. We should have at least as big a display as the Nativity Scene group. So I went about trying to make that happen by signing up for spots and building displays and setting them up in the park.
Right. I don't disagree. If you're going to have a spot for religions, every religion should have a spot, including atheism. What was the response to you?
The first year I just put one little sign up and I got no response. The second year I decided to sign up just as a Nativity Scene group had, and I signed up for 14 spots and just put my one display up with quotes from founding fathers about separation of church and state. And I got very little notice, just sort of one little article, until last year when I was actually able to build three kind of large displays and have nine other small displays. And the city's response has been very professional. Mm-hmm. It's just the Nativity Scene group that is very upset.
Ah, okay. So really the city's handling this well in your mind. How's the Christian Taliban not handling it well?
Well, they say, like you mentioned earlier, we're trying to steal Christmas. They believe their First Amendment right to freedom of speech is being hindered.
Has Bill O'Reilly shown up yet?
Bill O'Reilly had mentioned one little thing that I saw about this, and he claimed that the city of Santa Monica was going to stop Christmas carols in the park, and obviously he did not read the memo by the city, which specifically stated that carols will be allowed.
Has the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster put anything up?
No, they did not. Last year, one of my friends submitted an application to build a Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster display.
Right, the Pastafarians.
Was not drawing. He did not get a spot.
Oh, that's unfortunate. So it is kind of a lottery.
It is a lottery. It had never been a lottery. It had only been nativity scenes up there.
Right.
But after I signed up for 14 spots, they decided to limit the number of spots you could apply for to nine and have a lottery system. So I had, I think, 10 friends and I signed up for spots, and lo and behold, we got several of them.
Is that how the large Christian symbols, you know, is that how they got enough room for a nativity scene? Is they had a whole bunch of different people apply? Presumably.
No, you never had to worry about that because basically only the one group and maybe a couple other people ever have applied in the past.
Yeah.
It's just one group.
We're talking with Damon Vix. He's a set builder by trade, but an atheist in this context, an activist atheist. Damon, we just have a minute left, you know, before the commercial machine steps on us. What's the carry home message from this in your mind?
I think we're trying to rectify a lot of ills that happened during the McCarthy era, the whole atheist community. We want to get God and religion out of government so we can be free to live our lives.
Right. During the McCarthy era was when In God We Trust was put on our coins, for example, and added to the Pledge of Allegiance.
And the One Nation Under God is pretty offensive to a bunch of atheists and even Jehovah's Witnesses having to listen to this.
And to polytheists and pantheists.
Absolutely. And swearing to God in court and having religion in courtrooms, like the Ten Commandments and things like that. It's becoming pervasive. We're tired of it. We want our government to be free and open to everyone, not just for its people.
Yeah. So whether you're a member, and by the way, it increasingly is looking like atheists are not they're still an oppressed group in the United States politically, but they may not be a minority, depending on how you slice and dice various religions.
That's correct.
Fascinating. Damon Vix, atheist and soon to be star of the Bill O'Reilly Show. I bet you, Damon. Good luck. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you very much.
15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Are you a member of the atheist religion? If so, and you want to discuss it, give us a shout. Or is the war on Christmas hurting your community?
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Daniel in Vashon, Washington. Hey, Daniel, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, you know, I wanted to call in because I've been following the reports on this garment factory fire in Bangladesh last week.
Yeah, and there was another one yesterday that so freaked out people. Nobody died in it, but everybody evacuated. And now you've got a large chunk of the manufacturing sector, the garment making sector, apparently over 200 factories in Bangladesh where the workers are afraid to go to work right now. They're locking them out. Or I mean they're not showing up.
111 died, and what came out this morning, ABC was reporting that this is directly tied to Walmart and the manufacturing of goods for Walmart. And I think Sears is the other company that they mentioned. But, I mean, workers are not only being cheated of wages. Workers are dying here related to this company.
Yeah.
And what it reminds me of, I mean, it was eerie, was the Triangle Building Fire of 1911.
Triangle Shirtwaist. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, where 148 people died in a similar circumstance. They were locked in. They couldn't get out. This was a similar circumstance to the one in Bangladesh. And there was such an outrage at the time of 1911 that it jump-started labor movement in the United States.
Yeah.
And it also helped to lead to what we call social reforms, like government safety, job safety laws,
right.
Stuff like that.
Because the doors were chained shut on that, 10th or 15th floor or whatever it was of that building where the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory was operating. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And let me add to that, you know, we're very proud. Louise and I went to see the movie Lincoln the weekend before this last one. And with a couple of very dear friends of ours. And we're so proud here in the United States that we ended slavery. I would submit to you, Daniel, that we did not end slavery in the United States. We merely exported it. That's what you're describing. Not to justify slavery or the slaveholders in any way, but Jefferson at least looked into the eyes of his slaves. We have so sanitized slavery now that we no longer, we not only don't look into their eyes, we don't even acknowledge their presence. And yet you couldn't get all, you couldn't shop at Walmart if it wasn't for slave labor around, and not just Walmart, not to pick on one company, but, you know, just right across the board. It's really a tragedy. Daniel, thank you for the call. Bill in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you this morning?
I'm fine.
Well, it's still morning here in Albuquerque. But anyway, what the conversation you were having about Nancy Pelosi trying to put a stop to taking jobs overseas and making it easier.
She actually did. I mean, it passed the House. It would have passed the Senate if it wasn't for a Republican filibustering it.
Yeah, the one that won't fess up who he is. But my point is, these companies like Sincera, what we need to do is make it a possibility for the employees to buy the company.
Yes.
They know how to make the parts. They need middle management. If you can bring middle management back and put them in place to run it.
Yep.
If they're making $500 million a quarter, that's $2 billion a year, they can afford to give themselves a little bit of a pay raise, pay some benefits, buy the company, and pay it off in a very short period of time.
Yeah. Bill, I absolutely agree, and it's a model that should be the, by law, it should be the first option that a company has to look at when they're thinking of divesting. Instead, we've got all these very, very favorable tax policies that were put into place in the first 5 years of the Reagan administration as a consequence of lobbying by people like Mitt Romney and the Bain Capital bunch, who want, you know, to make it possible to load a company with debt and then use that debt to leverage the company out and, you know, to buy the company, these so-called leveraged buyouts. And they should be against the law. Frankly, they used to be against the law. And against the law. You didn't get the tax treatment. And I'm totally with you. Employee-owned businesses are the way to go. So thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Chad, Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Chad, what's on your mind today?
Hello. I like most of what you say, and I think you do a really good job.
But
I have two quick comments to make that where I kind of disagree. I am a moderate Christian, and I think everybody has the right to their religious point of view.
I agree.
But I don't think that being and everybody has the right to be an atheist, but atheism is not a religion. It's a point of view.
And well, then Christianity is not a religion. It's a point of view.
Well, it's got God and, you know, and all that stuff.
Well, atheism has not God.
Right. I was in a Panera Bread yesterday in Aurora, Colorado, and they now can't put up Christmas lights, which to me have nothing to do with the birth of Jesus Christ, which is what Christmas is.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Can't put up.
I agree with you. They're pagan. They're pagan symbols. We should honor the pagan religion. It's just that nobody will be honest. Very few Christians will be honest about the pagan symbols. You got to talk to a Jehovah's Witness to get the straight story on where Christmas trees and Christmas lights come from and Yule logs and stuff.
Right, I agree with that totally. But it was really sad that they can't put up anything to do with Christmas, to do with the holiday times, lights or anything, because of a lawsuit against religion.
Okay, and that was probably a lawsuit done by people who subscribe to the religion of atheism. Because if it wasn't a religion, they wouldn't be out proselytizing for it. They wouldn't be fighting lawsuits on its behalf. In my humble opinion, I realize it's going to get me a whole bunch more hate mail. Chad, thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to AM 760 there in Denver. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Okay, so in this war on Christmas era, I guess this is ultimately the question. When is atheism a religion, and when is it not a religion? When is atheism a religion and when is it not? My dad was an atheist. I don't know when he started. I don't know what his thoughts were the last few days of his life because he had stroked out and couldn't speak. But I did have, you know, when he was told that he had just a few months to live, I had a fairly long conversation with him about it, mostly listening. And, you know, he just said, hey, you know, we took you to church every Sunday when you were a little kid because we thought it was good for you. And your mom was really, you know, into it. and still is, or was. I mean, she's now passed on too. And he said, but I, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, but I always figured that, you know, when you die, the lights go off. That's it. Now, personally, I have to say, I think when you die, the light goes on. I think you become part of all of it. But I didn't tell my dad that. I didn't have, you know, like I said, I didn't want to debate him. I was just listening. And I had never known. I mean, here I was in my 50s, and my father was dying, and he comes out and tells me that he doesn't believe in all this stuff that he had been, you know, taking me to church ever since I can remember about. That is atheism as not a religion, right? My dad did not believe in any particular religion. He didn't even particularly strongly hold the belief that lights just go out. It's just the only thing that made sense to him. And so I would call my dad a non-religious atheist. Now, on the other hand, I have a friend who anytime anybody mentions religion, he's got to jump into the conversation and point out to them how stupid they are and how wrong they are. And you know, just aggressively promote his atheism. And I would say that he has simply found another religion. He's found a his religion you could call it the religion of reason. And in fact, I don't have a problem with calling it the religion of reason, because the fact of the matter is that there is no objective reality. So what, he's some kind of moral relativist? Well, no. Here's how it works. We know the world through six senses, maybe seventh and eighth, you know, arguably, but we have six basic senses. We can hear, in other words, vibrations vibrate our eardrum, and that produces data that our brain interprets as sound. Photons of light from a very, very tiny, small, tiny slice of the electromagnetic spectrum. A spectrum that, you know, if it were 100 feet wide, we're seeing a thousandth of an inch of it. That little thousandth of an inch of the electromagnetic spectrum strikes our eyes and produces electrical impulses, and we see that as vision. We have, you know, things can touch us, and we think we understand what they are. But the fact of the matter is that if they touch us in different ways, we'll interpret it differently. We have the sense of taste and smell, but the fact of the matter is that if you cover somebody's eyes and give them an onion to bite into, they may as well think it's an apple. It's kind of a mixed bag. So anyhow, we have sense, and we have taste, we have smell, and we have the vestibular system, the inner ear, which tells us whether, you know, where we are relative to gravity. It's a gravitometer. Those are the six senses that we have. Our sense of balance is the last one. And then maybe we have some sort of an intuitional sense. Maybe we have some sort of a religious sense. I don't know. But those six senses are not in dispute. Through those six senses, each one of which, I mean, keep in mind, our auditory sense, our ability to hear, for example, you can't hear anything below around 30 hertz, 20 hertz. You can't hear anything above around 17,500 hertz. In fact, 17.5 kilohertz is the frequency at which flyback transformers and old TV sets used to operate, because it was just above the threshold of hearing. And I remember when I was young, I could hear them. I could hear that whine, because when people are young, they can hear typically up to 18 or 19,000 cycles per second, sometimes even 20K. But as you get older, you know, your eardrum gets a little more rigid, and you get less able to hear those high frequencies. The point is that there's this huge spectrum of frequencies. There are sounds that our cats can hear, that I had dogs from the time I was born until just a few years ago. Our dogs could always hear, that I couldn't hear. So how can I know what reality really is when I'm only seeing a very tiny slice of the electromagnetic spectrum? I'm only hearing a very tiny slice of the auditory spectrum. I'm only feeling things in a hugely subjective way. You know, a light touch is perceived as a tickle, but if you push down nearby, you activate large nerves, which shut down the small nerves, and you can no longer tell what the light touches. That's why scratching makes itching go away. So even our tactile sense, our sense of feeling is subject, not just highly subjective, but, you know, very narrowly defined. Our senses of smell and taste are easily fooled. And our vestibular sense, our sense of balance, you know, close your eyes and spin around three times, it's gone. So how can you say that you know the world through reason? How can you say that you know the world, period? We know this little teeny tiny slice of the world that we, through our common shared senses, say, oh, this is how the world is. But if you were to discuss it with a mosquito who sees the world in infrared, you'd get a completely different world. So you say, well, you know, my religion is reason. I understand the world through reason. That's all there is. I have it all figured out. Yeah, right. With your ability to sense and understand perhaps 1/1,000th of all the available data that's out there that's constantly bombarding us. You're not measuring the x-rays that are hitting you. You're not measuring the IR, the infrared radiation, the ultraviolet radiation. You're not, those are just near to visual light. You're not sensing radio frequency radiation. You're not, you know, from ultra low frequency, from ULF all the way up to multi gigahertz radiation. You're not sensing any of that. There's huge chunks of reality that we have no ability to sense. How can we call ourselves, you know, reason driven rational machines? I mean, we can try. We try to make sense out of things. And we do it based on what we can perceive, and we invent machines that allow us to perceive more than we understand so that we can say, okay, this is what an atom actually looks like if you look at it with an electron microscope, or what a molecule looks like. I don't know that an electron microscope could see an atom, but you know, here's what I'm – but we're kind of taking that on faith because it's through our machine. But even at that, okay, we can agree on all this stuff, but that doesn't mean we understand everything. And therefore, I'd say even reason is a religion if somebody's evangelical about it. If they think that that is the beginning and end of all that there is. See, this is the mistake that these, you know, fundamentalist Christians make, the Christian Taliban. World, you know, like Marco Rubio the other day. He was asked, how old is the world?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's something that theologians dispute.
Well, maybe theologians dispute it. You know, is the world 6,000 years old? Is it 6,512 years old? Is it 5,230 years old? Is it 3.5 billion years old? Well, that would be since life began. Is it 5 billion years old since the Earth first formed? How old is the Earth? Well, we don't know, Marco Rubio says. Well, actually, yeah, we probably do. So, you know, that's pretty obviously religion. But I would say that, you know, frankly, you know, the only people I think are genuine, what you might call atheists, are really the agnostics, which is like my dad was, saying, you know, I don't really know. This is what I think. Probably nothing there. Not certain of it, but, you know, certain enough that I'll live my life based on that belief. And he was a good moral man, but he didn't need a Ten Commandment monument, you know, that Judge Moore was dragging around the country to make him a good moral man. He was one of the finest and most moral people I've ever met my whole entire life, my father. And I'm not saying that just because he was my dad. And my mother, on the other hand, was, you know, just, she was a spiritual Christian who had been visited by her dead relatives and could tell me the details of it and knew the stories. I mean, literally. When she was giving birth to my youngest brother, she had a near-death experience, and her grandmother visited her. And she had a number of these kinds of experiences, these supernatural experiences. She was absolutely convinced that right next to us, as to paraphrase William James, separated by the filmiest of tissues and openable by the smallest requisite touch, entire other worlds existed. That every now and then we would get just the faintest glimpse of. And, you know, I share that perspective, only I share it, you know, largely through my experiences as a teenager with psychoactive substances that shaman used to crack open the worlds and step into the other world to do work on behalf of other people. So, but does, you know, so when does atheism become a religion? In simple answer, atheism becomes a religion when it becomes evangelical. And in my opinion, and spare me the 400 emails about, you know, how can you have a religion that's about not having something? Well, I'll tell you right now, Christians do not believe that Muhammad was the prophet. They've got a not belief. Does that make them not Christians?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Muslims, on the other hand, don't believe Jesus was the Messiah. They believe he was a prophet. So he was not the Messiah. So does that make them not religious?
Just another Cyber Monday.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's Cyber Monday. No, I'm not going to do that one either. But again, I mean, you know, should we have a nation of people who are so poorly paid that they have to wait for Cyber Monday or Black Friday in order to just buy things? You know, it seems like a real problem, you know, to me. I don't get it. With us is Pastor Heidi McGinnis of the Christian Solidarity International, CSI, Christian Solidarity International disclosure. Actually, this is kind of bragging, I guess. CSI helped Ellen Ratner and me and my son Justin and Joe and Sherry Madison and Rusty Humphreys go from here in the United States all the way to South Sudan near the border with Darfur, where CSI has been bringing back slaves from North Sudan back to their home territories in South Sudan. And we were there. In fact, there's a couple of pictures of me in Sudan. If you go to TomHartman.com and click on the Tom link, I'm pretty sure that there's a couple of pictures there. So, Heidi McGinnis, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. It's wonderful to be on your program. Thank you so much. And when are you and Justin going to return?
I don't know. I know
it was wonderful that you went.
Thank you. It was very eye-opening for us, and it was not my first trip to Africa or into a war zone or a conflict area, but it was quite remarkable. So tell us about Ellen Ratner's Goats for the Old Goats program, the survival kits, the hearts that are being made by women in your post-traumatic stress program.
Oh, my goodness.
Tell us what's going on over there.
You know, Ellen Ratner is a turbocharged humanitarian, and this Goat for the Old Goat program is something that she instituted that is so amazing, because a goat given to a person freed from slavery, which you have seen the people with your own eyes, you've documented their suffering with your own words, and so you know exactly what it's like. But I don't think you've been there yet when they receive a goat. And Tom, they'll carry that goat like a baby, or like a toy, because it's the first thing that they've received that's their very own. And of course, it allows them to make a living. They can sell the milk, they can sell the cheese, and of course goats grow up and have little goats, and so it becomes a total economy. It's such a wonderful thing that that Ellen Ratner has done. So every time someone is freed from slavery, they receive a goat. And I remember I've seen your name that has been held by a freed slave, and then we try to help the person make sure that the goat gets in the picture too, because that's very important for us. And so let people know that they will receive a photograph that either Alan will take or I will take or my colleagues, John or Gunnar, will take, and they will receive that.
Now, let me just interrupt if I may. That's if you do what I did, which is you go to the website goatsfortheoldgoat.com and make a contribution to buy a goat. And it's not much. I don't remember the exact amount.
$60.
$60.
For some people, Tom, they go in with another person to split the cost, and then they have both of their names.
Or they'll do it on behalf of another person and give the picture to that person as a holiday gift.
In honor of, or even in memory of.
Yes.
It's a wonderful gift. I call her the divine goat goddess.
Ellen would love
and
that.
And I have a picture of her kissing a goat. I've tried to discourage her not to do that.
I've seen her kiss goats too. And in fact, when we were there, she had made friends with a particular goat, and the whole village, Gokmachara, they were going to have this big celebration for us on the last day that we were there. And when they brought out the stew that they'd made in this giant pot, Ellen was horrified to discover that the goat was in it. But she's pretty much a vegetarian.
They were showing honor to you all.
That's what they were doing exactly. Yeah. And she tried, you know, and you got to be very careful. She also had this chicken that she carried around with her for 3 days. It's Ellen is a pretty remarkable woman. Anyhow, also you have women who are survivors who were slaves in many cases, who were raped repeatedly.
Yes.
Violated in other ways.
And saw their family members killed. And,
yes.
And that's beautiful. They make hearts from Swarovski crystals.
Mm-hmm.
And they get together once a week, Tom. And our friend Luca Garankenye teaches them English, teaches them math, teaches them how to make the hearts. They receive money from the heart. And they receive instruction, and it's amazing. I've seen them go from being so destitute and desolate and despairing. They also receive trauma alleviating training and breathing training to be able to get rid of the nightmares. And now you see them, and they can provide for their families. They have on dresses. And the transformation is remarkable.
Mm, yeah.
And those are available on www.goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And, of
right.
course, they receive funds for each heart and instruction and for them because, as you remember, the schools were, for decades, there were no schools.
Right.
Now they receive instruction and they have the funds to send their children to school.
Mm-hmm.
But even more importantly, they have group therapy, and during that time, it's a new beginning for them.
Yeah, this is a remarkable work. And we should, you know, just to put an explanation to the goats for the old goat, this was an idea that Ellen came up with as she was approaching 60, and she said, I'm going to become an old goat, so we're going to do goats for the old goat. The old goat is Ellen,
and she's
quite proud of it.
I can't bear to call her that, so that I say divine goat goddess.
Yeah, well, you know, I say this lovingly, and Ellen
she
is...
She likes to be called an old goat.
That's right. She's quite proud of it. And
yes.
So goatsfortheoldgoat.com is Ellen Ratner's site, and all of the money, 100% of the money that you
100%.
Give there goes to either the Women in Their Hearts program or to buying a goat for a person who's been freed from slavery. Pastor Heidi McGinnis, thank you so much for being with
us
today.
Thank you so much, Tom. And, of course, we await your return, yours and Justin's. And thank you for all of your good work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Is it possible... Welcome back to the third hour of our program, by the way. Is it possible that a guy named Grover, like Grover Norquist, the multimillionaire K Street lobbyist who's long been funded by billionaires, is an enemy of the state? I mean, does this sound like an enemy of the state?
Hello there. This is your old pal, Grover.
Oh, sorry. Wrong Grover. Okay. Enemy of the state? Not the Muppet. No. Grover Norquist. Enemy of the state is pretty strong language, but consider that Grover Norquist has connived over the years to get hundreds, literally hundreds of members of Congress to violate their own oath of office by pledging a higher oath to keep billionaires' taxes low, a higher oath than their pledge to the Constitution itself. The requirement for members of Congress to swear an oath to our country is in the Constitution itself, by the way. It's in Article 6. The senators and representatives shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. That's what it says in the Constitution. So starting with the very first Congress in 1789, members were sworn in by saying, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support the Constitution of the United States. By the way, the or affirm part was put in there by the atheists in Congress who said, you know, swearing, you know, you swear on a Bible, that's a religious thing, so it's got to be swear or affirm. And then everybody said, okay, that's fine. But during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln supported and Congress passed on July 2nd, 1862, legislation requiring an oath that, in addition to that, said that members of Congress had not previously engaged in any criminal or disloyal conduct. That was the phrase. And that, of course, would have included pledging loyalty to the Confederacy, which is why this was called the Ironclad Test Oath, the one that was passed in 1862. It was designed to keep Confederate sympathizers out of Congress. If a member swore it, the Congressional Oath, the Ironclad Oath, and it was discussed that he'd previously violated it by swearing an oath to the Confederacy, that member of the House of Representatives of the Senate could be prosecuted for perjury for violating his oath of office. After the Civil War, that oath was replaced with one that didn't specifically exclude former members of Congress or of the Confederacy, but still required members to pledge an oath, first and foremost, to the Constitution. It's now called the Modern Oath. It was enacted in 1884. It is used to this day. And its first sentence says, I do solemnly swear or affirm, atheists got that in there, that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, and that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion. Now, how can you evade the Constitution? Well, the Constitution to which they're taking this modern oath explicitly says that Congress has the explicit power to impose taxes, both to pay for our defense and to provide for the general welfare of the nation. Very first sentence, Article 1, Section 8. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Quote, end quote, from the Constitution. So how is it possible, when the Constitution explicitly says that one of the specific jobs of Congress is to lay and collect taxes, and the oath they take explicitly says that they will do so, quote, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, end quote, how could it possibly be that a member of Congress could swear an oath to a multimillionaire K Street lobbyist to refuse to perform one of their congressional duties? And what sort of member of Congress would willingly swear an oath to a front man for a small group of billionaires that member of Congress would violate the oath he or she swore to follow the Constitution without mental reservations or purpose of evasion? Here's a question. Is not the man or a man who essentially uses threats, blackmail, the billionaire money will be used to politically destroy members of Congress who refuse to sign his pledge, is he not an enemy of the state itself? Or at least an enemy of the very Constitution that lawmakers have sworn to uphold without mental reservation or evasion? I would submit to you that what Grover Norquist is doing is he is requiring people to swear an oath to him that they will have mental reservations or will evade part of their constitutional duty having to do with raising taxes. And that explicitly and specifically makes him, in my mind, if not an enemy of the state, at least an enemy of the Constitution. I think this is just fundamentally wrong. So, a lot going on, by the way. A couple of things I needed to share with you. This is hysterical. Fox News had on Mr. Ricks. He's been on this program before. Tom Ricks. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning author and military defense analyst, and he understands, you know, anything military. He knows what's going on. So Fox News has been ginning up this thing because they are the, you know, the official media arm of the Republican Party. They've been ginning up this thing that President Obama is lying about and hiding something about Benghazi. At first it was Susan Rice's, you know, and now they're backing off because it's been proven that they were lying about that or just made it up. But they're hysterical about it. So they get him on TV. And I just have to play this clip for you. You can find it over at thinkprogress.org. Media Matters probably has it as well, mediamatters.org. This was supposed to be a five-minute interview, which is a typical hit on television. Typically, you're on for between 4 and 6 minutes when you're on a TV show. This runs a minute 38 seconds. And there's a reason why, and you will get that reason. You will understand that reason when he gets to the very end and he says, basically, Fox News is an arm of the Republican Party. Just listen to this. This is hysterical. It starts out with the Fox announcer, John Scott, the Fox, you know, the Republican toady, starting out.
Right now, pressure mounting on the Obama administration over its response to the deadly attack on our consulate in Benghazi, as Catherine Herridge reported just minutes ago. Several top GOP lawmakers are backing off their criticism of UN Ambassador Susan Rice, instead focusing on the White House. Two senators even expressing concerns about a possible White House cover-up. Let's talk about Tom Ricks. He is author of The Generals. He has spent decades covering our military. He joins us now. Senator John McCain has said in the past that he would block any attempt to nominate Susan Rice to become Secretary of State. She's currently the UN ambassador. He seems to be backing away from that. What do you make of it?
I think that Benghazi generally was hyped by this network especially.
Uh-oh.
And that now that the campaign is over, I think he's backing off a little bit. They're not going to stop Susan Rice from being Secretary of State.
When you have four people dead, including the first UN ambassador, U.S. ambassador in more than 30 years, how do you call that hype?
How many security contractors died in Iraq, do you know?
I don't.
No, nobody does because nobody cared. We know that several hundred died, but there was never an official count done of security contractors dead in Iraq. So when I see this focus on what was essentially a small firefight, I think, number one, I've covered a lot of firefights. It's impossible to figure out what happens in them sometimes. And second, I think that the emphasis on Benghazi has been extremely political, partly because Fox was operating as a wing of the Republican Party.
All right. Tom Ricks, thanks very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You can tell this guy's got somebody yelling in his ear, get him off the air! 15 minutes past the hour. Oh, that just made my day. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, Grover Norquist undermining our democracy, our Christmas story. Are you an atheist? What about the war on Christmas? Black Friday? Lots going on. We'll be right back with all. Goodbye, Grover. Yeah, he says this ain't his first rodeo. He's been around before. He's going to hang on to his power over the Republican Party. I'm skeptical. Mark in San Francisco, are you?
No, I'll tell you, this Grover Norquist is undermining democracy, and we really don't have a democracy as long as we have somebody like him and people taking pledges to him that are in the Republican Party.
It just baffles me why any elected official would make a written pledge to a multimillionaire K Street lobbyist. I don't get it.
You know what's more than that, Tom, is that the mainstream media legitimizes this guy.
Yeah.
Lets the Republican Party get away with it like it's accepted.
Yeah, arguably it was Grover Norquist who brought down George Herbert Walker Bush because he said, you know, read my lips, no new taxes. I'm going to follow Grover's pledge. And then he, as president, he raised taxes. And boy, Grover got after him, and that was the end of his presidency.
Well, you know, Tom, we should do what we can to call these pledge takers and tell them that we feel that they're, undermining democracy in this country, and they ought to be ashamed of themselves for doing this. And they're just getting away with it, Tom, but you know what? We need to call them out in front of the American people and put them on trial.
Well,
this isn't democracy as long as we have this going on.
Yeah, let's talk about the trial of public opinion. I mean, I wrote an op-ed, which is basically the story that I just shared with you. You know, is Grover Norquist an enemy of the state? It's over at alternet.com right now. And you know, basically, you know, saying this, that I think that he's, what he's doing at the very least is un-American. I'm with you. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Mark, I'm sorry, that wasn't Mark. This is Mark. Mark in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This is Mark in Ann Arbor. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard you talk in the past about this idea of estate wealth. You know, Jefferson talked about it being a danger to the democracy, to the republic. Thomas Paine talked about it, and Adam Smith as well.
Accumulated wealth within a single family or a single institution, yes.
You know, and I seem to recall reading, and I'm not sure who it was, reading that they actually, one of those gentlemen, and maybe even somebody else, suggested at the that estate actually be divvied up among all the citizens and returned in the form of a rebate. Do you recall that?
I'm not sure. And Thomas Paine wrote a very, very underread, largely unknown tract called Agrarian Justice, which is, in my opinion, it was the most brilliant thing he wrote. In it, he proposed Social Security. He proposed that every person at birth should get basically an annuity that they could start cashing in when they got old enough to go to college that would pay for their college and give them an income throughout their lives, thus turning everybody into a middle-class citizen. He proposed what today we might call food stamps and unemployment insurance. Many of the things that he suggested that the government should be the employer of last resort. Many of the things that became the New Deal you will find in Thomas Paine's tract. It's really more of a booklet than a book. It's probably 70 pages long, called Agrarian Justice. I'm not sure. It's been at least a decade since I read it.
I know I read that among one of those gentlemen. And,
I know,
you know
he advocated an estate tax. So.
Many of these founding fathers that these righties like to quote all the time as being gods were much more progressive than people know about.
Yes.
And, you know, the fear that Jefferson had about the rise of the aristocracy, you've been talking about Walmart and the five heirs. That is absolutely stunning to me that we would allow something like that to happen. And, you know, in a real way, what can be done about that? I mean, is it going to take a Teddy Roosevelt or an Andrew Jackson who says, Supreme Court be damned, I'm going to do the right thing and let history judge me?
Or Teddy Roosevelt who puts into place the estate tax. I mean, the estate tax was put into place to stop the dynasties that had emerged in the previous generation in the 1880s and 1890s, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Mellons, the DuPonts, the, you know, go on and on through the Gould, all these other fortunes. And you know, Teddy Roosevelt looked at that, Republican President Roosevelt looked at that and said, this is, as Thomas Jefferson pointed out, a danger to democracy, that these people are wealthy
Absolutely.
Enough that they can manipulate the state itself. And so the estate tax went into place. And interestingly, the phrase death tax, which was coined by Frank Luntz and promoted over a decade long period. We were about 5 years into that thing being promoted before somebody outed the fact that the Walton heirs, these five heirs who own an amount of wealth equal to the bottom 40% of Americans, that these five heirs had funded the effort to get the phrase death tax out there. And they actually got the estate tax down to zero, either this year or last year.
Which absolutely supports the argument why we need to do away with this. I mean, when you start to alter democracy in such a way, you know, I've been telling people this, and I've been reading Stiglitz lately. His new book came out in June, and he makes a lot of these similar arguments that it actually is a danger to democracy itself. It's not about a lot of my friends will say, oh, you're just jealous of the wealthy or you hate on the rich. That's not it at all. I think I welcome you, but it works hard and saves money. You know what I mean? I celebrate that. However, when it gets to the point that it is now, it's obviously deleterious to the entire republic. And I look at these people like junkies. They're junkies that have they need an intervention to save them from themselves.
Well, I think first of all, let's be clear. Among the billionaires in the United States, we're talking about a subset of them, and among that subset of billionaires, I believe there is a group that are mentally ill, and the mental illness that they suffer from is one that when you see it in a poor middle-class person and they fill their house with old newspapers and string and bottles and keep every tin can that they've ever opened and you have to, you know, walk through pathways,
absolutely.
It's called hoarding. And it's a form of obsessive compulsive disorder. It's a serotonin associated mental, you know, brain chemistry deficiency or problem. And, or somebody who compulsively washes their hands, you know, the OCT takes a lot of different forms. And if the object of your obsession is money and the access to money triggers that compulsion, then you end up with this Scrooge McDuck syndrome, you know. Walt Disney characterized this, Scrooge McDuck swimming in his money bin. And you got people like Shelley Adelson now, you know, basically, and the Koch brothers, funding entire political movements and political candidates. Just one, two, three people. I agree with you, Mark. That is destructive to democracy. 27 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how do we fix our Christmas story? What do we do about Black Friday? Is atheism a religion? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very ingloviously ugly, the good. Christina Figueres. In an interview with Yale Environment 360, Figueres, the top UN diplomat for international climate negotiations, said the Superstorm Sandy serves as yet another wake-up call for the U.S. to cut carbon pollution. She also asked why the United States was willing to let other countries pursue clean energy technologies at the expense of American jobs and economic growth. Figueres also predicted increased frustration with the United States if lawmakers in Washington fail to participate in the global fight to curb climate change, say that one three times, over the next 4 years. Superstorm Sandy should be a wake-up call to everyone in this country, but let's see if politicians on Capitol Hill get that message and finally do something to curb climate change. I did it that right. The bad, Carly Fiorina. On Sunday's edition of Meet the Press, Fiorina complained that it's not fair. The public worker unions are so rich. Take a listen.
Let us accept Reverend Al's point and the president's point about fairness. But equally, it is not fair that public employee union pensions and benefits are so rich now that cities and states are going bankrupt and college tuition is going up 25% and 30%, or police and firefighters being cut. There's a lot that isn't fair right now.
I'm not sure what planet Ms. Fiorina is on, but back down here on Earth, public workers are anything but rich, and public employee unions are under constant attack as increasing numbers of communities across the nation move to privatize the commons. The only thing not fair here is that Ms. Fiorina is worth over $50 million and is still paying lower taxes than working class Americans, including public employees, who are struggling to survive. And the very, very ugly Fox So-Called News. In an op-ed posted on the Fox So-Called News website, self-described social critic Suzanne Benker argues that women's newfound roles as family breadwinners and their strides toward gender equality have caused them to become angry, irritable, and unappealing to marriageable men in America. Benker goes on to say that women aren't women anymore. Apparently, it's a terrible thing that women are becoming more successful in the workplace and that they are finally being allowed to catch up to their male counterparts. Fox News saw how well the war on women worked out for the Republicans this past election. You'd think they'd have learned their lesson. But instead, they're posting op-eds about how awful it is for women to be successful. Op-ed written, by the way, ironically, by a successful woman. And that is very, very ugly. That is really ironic, you know. I mean, that's quite incredible that I'll leave it at that. It's enough. The folks in the chat room, it never ceases. Tom, comparing religion, atheism to religion is just the same as when the low info voters try to claim that both parties are the same brush full of tar. All right. Tom, I like Bill Maher's analogy. Atheism is a religion like Off is a TV channel. Well, that's my point. If you own a TV, off is one of the options. So if you are a TV owner, off is one of the channels available to you. If you're not a TV owner, then you're not a TV owner, right? So if you're not religious, atheism is not part of your lexicon. But if you insist that atheism is the truth, then you've got this box that says truth on it. And one of the channels is off for all the other channels. See, I, you know, respectfully disagree with Bill Maher. As much as I like everything else he says, and it was a great honor and pleasure to be on his show. He says, Tom is making me uncomfortable about my pagan holiday symbols. What is wrong with Christmas tree lights? Absolutely nothing, Mark. Christmas tree lights are great. When we lived in Germany, we lived in the mountains up in the north of the Frankenwald, north of Bavaria. And the people there, they still tell stories about how, you know, back before Christianity, the local, apparently there's even some remnants of these, you know, they'd find these like fire rings around the, where the biggest tree was. And they had, you know, calendar stones like Stonehenges. And so they knew the priests, the wise elders, they knew when the shortest day of the year was coming, which is right around December 23rd, 24th, 25th, depending on, you know, the calendar. Because they all dated it all on lunar calendar. And so on the shortest day of the year, as the people are getting more and more nervous, like, you know, boy, the sun is like going out. And if it goes out altogether, it's going to get really dark. And then the bears will get us and we're going to be in, you know, it's not going to get warm again and we'll freeze to death. This is terrible stuff. And the priest comes out and says, I've got the solution. I'll save you all. I'm going to reignite the sun. Really? You can do that? Oh, yes, I have magical powers. That's why you all should give me 10% of your income. Income? Yes, 10% of all your goats and sheep and you know, the whatever you float down the river, you know, and whatever you're making. Yes, give me 10% of it. And you'll do what? I'll bring the sun back. Oh, let's see that. Let's see that happen. Okay. It's December 22nd. The days are getting really short. We're all really nervous. Ah, but I, the priest, I'm going to save you all. I'm going to... And he goes up to the top of the mountain and finds the tallest tree. And they're, you know, pine trees burn really well. The pine tar burns pretty good. And so they would, they put some tinder, some kindling around the base of it, and they'd set it on fire. And pretty soon this entire tree is just in flames. And for miles around, people can see this giant tree on fire on the 22nd or 23rd or 24th of December. And they're all looking at it going, whoa, you know, is that going to reignite the sun? And the next day is, of course, the day after the winter solstice. The next day, the sun is just there a minute or two longer. And the day after that, it's like 5 minutes longer. And the day after that, it's 10 minutes longer. And within a few weeks, it's obvious the sun is getting brighter and brighter. And the days are getting longer and longer. And all the people are saying, he did it again. Hey, here's your 10%, buddy. Thank you very much. Next year, I'll do it again. But let's not talk about that. Let's just kind of forget about that for a year. Okay. And in the spring, I'll tell you how to make the fields grow. How do you make the fields grow? Oh, everybody eats eggs and we take bunnies and slit their throats and put their blood on the field. I'm not making this up. This is how the fertility ritual that they did in Europe to make sure that they would have a good harvest. Fertility, you know, bunnies reproduce like crazy and eggs are like, you know, a symbol of fertility. They are fertility, right? And so people would eat eggs and they would butcher rabbits, put their blood on the fields. So what do we do in the spring solstice? No, it's the winter solstice, the spring equinox, right? Equinox, yeah. What do we do at the spring equinox? We have bunnies and eggs, only we call it Ichthar, after the goddess, the Greek goddess. The goddess of fertility. No, we call it Easter, which is after Ichthar. Anyhow, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was interested to hear you talking about the religion of reason. Reminded me of what Robert Persig called in his 1974 book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, the Church of Reason.
Mm.
and how to examine reason. Reason can't examine itself.
Yeah, I agree. Have you ever read Plato's commentaries on the shadow in the cave wall?
Indeed, I have.
Okay, so I thought that was one of the most eloquent early, dissections of the whole concept of reason. But in any case,
yeah, we were raised Lutheran, and us four boys, we don't go to church anymore. My mom still goes every Sunday, but except for my older brother, my oldest brother became a very right-wing conservative, born-again evangelical Christian. And about 10 years ago, 10 or 12 years ago, when my eyesight began taking a turn for the much worse from the disease, and my partner was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's since passed away.
Okay.
But anyway, at the time, my brother said, you know, you really, at these kinds of times, this is when you really need to turn to God. And, of course, feeling desperate, as we both did, I said, okay, maybe. Or so I started really reading the Bible diligently, and I do know how to read, so I guess that was the part that is of a chagrin to him now. But I did notice things like the birth narrative of Jesus is quite interesting, and our Christmas pageant is actually kind of screwed up, so I had kind of a lot of empathy for Charlie Brown and being the director of the play. In Matthew, you know, there are wise men that follow the star to Bethlehem, where apparently Mary and Joseph live. So the wise, but there are
they traveled there to be taxed. They lived up north in the Galilee.
Yeah, but in Luke, there are no wise men.
Right.
There are shepherds, and Joseph and Mary came to Bethlehem, I guess from Nazareth, because of a Roman census that Augustus ordered that everyone should return to their home of the city of their ancestors, which would be can you imagine the chaos this would create throughout the empire that everybody's traveling to and fro, but there seems to be no other record of this anywhere in history except for in the Gospel of Luke.
Right.
Of course, there's no manger in Matthew, but there is in Luke.
Right.
So it's hard to tell. So we sort of collide these or what, confabulate.
Conflate them. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Paul, this is one of the things about, you know, oral traditions being written down and then being taken as literal is that they get all screwed up. Paul, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Okay, Noah wants to tell me that atheism is not a religion. We'll see. Stick around. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, atheism is indeed a religion when it's evangelical.
Okay, well, are you ready to do some contemporary-style analytic philosophy, Tom?
Certainly.
All right, let's do it. All right, first of all, we need to agree on a definition of the word religion before we can go anywhere. So what
exactly?
What is your definition of a religion?
My definition of a religion, to paraphrase Paul, is a belief in things unseen and unknowable with certainty. And I would add to that what makes it an evangelical religion, which is really my definition of a religion, or my definition of a certifiable religion, is that someone not only believes in that, but aggressively tries to get others to share that belief.
Okay. Well, I have several other definitions from my Oxford American Dictionary. Number one being belief in the existence of a superhuman controlling power, especially of God or gods, usually expressed in worship. Number two, a particular system of faith and, not the exclusive or, and worship, for example, the Christian religion. And number three, something which I think maybe we can agree on, something compared to religious faith as a controlling influence on a person's life.
But see, I would say that all three of those, atheism fits perfectly all three of those. Read me the first one again.
A belief in the existence of a superhuman controlling power, especially of God or God.
Okay, a superhuman controlling power. An atheist would, I believe, acknowledge that there are all kinds of forces beyond their control that are shaping and determining their lives and the future of this planet. Global warming, for example, a superhuman controlling power. Religious person may say,
natural.
Pardon?
I take that superhuman controlling power to be,
I'm taking it literally. It's larger than humans. Superhuman means larger than human. Okay, there's all kinds of, the sun is superhuman, and it controls our weather.
Okay.
So that's definition one. What was the second definition?
A particular system of faith and worship.
Okay, if a person believes that there is no God, how is that not a system of faith?
And worship. We got to look at this as we.
Okay, then now we've got to now we have to define worship, which means flip to the W's in the dictionary. So let's not go there because let's not drag this. So what's your let's you and I debate rather than me and the dictionary debate.
Okay, well let's say that it's something compared to religious faith as a controlling influence on a person's life.
Okay,
I can agree to that. But in that case, vegetarianism is a religion.
Yep.
If you're really into painting, that's a religion.
If it controls your life, I would say vegetarianism can be.
And you get your meals that way and your income, whatever, and you really enjoy it.
There have been times when my religion was vegetarianism in my life. There are some people for whom football is a religion, don't you think?
Yeah, but in that sense, it's nothing like the way that Christianity is a religion or Islam or Buddhism.
I see people. Hey, listen, over the holidays, we watched Notre Dame was playing University of Southern California. We watched the Notre Dame-USC game. And you tell me that the people in those stands that were all painted up in gold or in red and, with their faces painted and their signs and everything – are not even more enthusiastic than your average holy roller in church.
Well, but I wouldn't call it a religion.
Yeah. It's stretching it to call it a religion because they don't believe that if Notre Dame wins the game, they're going to have a better afterlife. Although
right.
Some of the players seem to believe it. I noticed several of them kneeling down and crossing themselves on the field. I thought, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but they're also kind of crossbreeding Christianity or whatever their particular faith is with their football.
Yeah. So anyhow, you have not succeeded in convincing me that atheism is not a religion.
My view is that atheism is a rejection of all religions.
But a rejection is a positive thing. It's an affirmation.
No, it's a negative thing.
No, a negative thing. This is Robert McKee is brilliant about this. If you ever read his book Story or attended his seminars on how to write screenplays and novels, the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. That is the double negative. If the double positive is love and the positive is like, the negative is hate and the double negative is indifference. The extreme opposite. So I would say the extreme opposite of religion is indifference. And, if you are asserting a negative belief, that's an assertion. That's not the opposite of asserting belief. That is simply asserting something else. It's asserting non-belief.
Okay.
I would say somebody who is a true atheist, if you're suggesting that atheism means somebody with no belief system about anything that exists beyond what they can sense with their very limited senses, then
my dog.
Yeah. I would say that you just never think of it. Well, maybe that person's a real atheist or a real agnostic, actually. But anybody
I could get my two cents in.
We have a minute left.
I just so we agree that football can be like a religion, or you can have religious. It can be a controlling influence on a person's life. It can be compared to like a religious faith in that way. Certain other activities or.
Yeah, and therefore atheism can be too, or not. In my opinion, there are many people who are atheists who are not religious about their atheism, and therefore it's not a religion for them. And the example I gave when I started telling the whole story was my dad. But I do think that for many people, it, you know, if particularly, you know, if they're going to like call into a talk show and defend it, it's a religion. Noah, we will have to live to debate this another day because we are flat out of time. The show is over. Coming up tomorrow, when you envision taking your kids to Santa for those memorable holiday pictures, the image of tots in Santa's lap come to mind. It's happening in Scottsdale, Arizona. Second Amendment advocate Noel Flasterstein coming up.
TomHartmann.com.
And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.